Hello, this is Julianne Good, and this is Psych One-on-One. Welcome. We are here to make psychology more understandable with tips and information for you and your family and friends to make your lives easier. Tonight, my special guest is Dr. Joy Shabander, and we are going to be speaking about prostitution. I'm going to tell you a little bit about Dr. Shabander first. She graduated with her BA and MS degrees from East Central University in Oklahoma in mental health counseling. She earned her Doctor of Philosophy degree from Capella University in Minnesota. Dr. Shabander is also a licensed professional counselor, nationally certified counselor, licensed alcohol and drug counselor, and a certified behavioral health case manager. Dr. Shabander has worked in the field of substance abuse, criminal behavior, and mental health counseling with children, families, and adults throughout her academic and licensure experience. Dr. Shabander has also worked in domestic violence, sexual assault, and addiction. She worked with various drug courts, probation and parole systems, and foster care services in Oklahoma, Texas, Colorado, and California. Dr. Shabander has provided expert witness testimony, clinical assessments, crisis intervention, group individual counseling, and case management services to multiple populations. Most recently, Dr. Shabander worked with Dallas Police Special Task Force on Prostitution Diversion to provide an alternate treatment option to incarceration for truck stop prostitutes. Welcome, Dr. Shabander.
Hello, Julianne. Thank you.
How are you doing this evening?
I'm very well. When you read my biography, it really sounds like I've did something. I don't walk around thinking of myself like that, but I guess I have been able to do a lot of amazing things.
Yes, you have, and that's wonderful. Thank you for serving the public so well.
Well, I enjoy it. I love working with what's considered the throwaway or trash populations. Those are my favorite to work with.
Yeah, we were discussing that when I met you initially, and I got to see some of your dissertation work, and that's why I want you to come on to the program, because this is a topic that is not spoken about very much. And the first question I want to ask you is, what is a typical profile of a truck stop prostitute?
Well, and you make a good point, just starting out, this is something most people don't talk about, and we also don't realize how much it's happening. Any city that has an interstate has a thriving truck stop prostitute population. That's how they operate, and it's from coast to coast. I wanted to start out by sharing a case study with you, and this is kind of the way to best describe what a typical truck stop prostitute. So this is one of the ladies that I worked with, and I had the privilege of watching her go from beginning to end, from being a truck stop prostitute to having success and recovery and having a whole new life. But I'm going to start at the beginning. Her stage name is Peaches, and that's what I'm going to call her just for anonymity, or however you say that word, for privacy's sake.
Yes.
But she is one of the case studies that I also use in my dissertation. Peaches grew up in a small town in Oklahoma, and she had verbal, emotional, and physical abuse from both her mother and her father, who were addicted to methamphetamine and to alcohol. And then she also had sexual abuse from her brother. And she stayed in that home until she was about 16, and then she ran away. She ended up hitchhiking from Oklahoma City to Dallas. And when she got to Dallas, she was 16 and had no skills, no way of really, you know, making it on her own, and she started dancing at a club, which then led to stripping at the club, which then led to a lot of different substance use, but the main one, and this is one that is very, very common in the truck stop population, is crack cocaine. And the years just kept going by. She was 5 years in and kept telling herself she was going to get out of it, and they call it the game. Get out of the game and make a good life for herself, and then she's 10 years into it, and by that time she has a pimp that helps set it up. And they would just go to the different interstates and all the trucks that are parked in the interstates at the rest stops, they would just go from one to another. And that's how they made their money. And by this time, at least for Peaches, it was all about just getting her next bump, just to get high again. It wasn't any other thing driving her at that point. I think she had said when she was younger, it was just to get away from the abuse. And then she felt beautiful when she was dancing. When I don't think any little girl sits on her bed and says, you know, I want to be a truck stop prostitute or prostitute at all.
Right.
Yeah. So anyway, she ends up in our sweeps. And what a sweep is, this is when we would go out with the Dallas Police Department and we would set up kind of like a horseshoe of RVs with different community professionals. One RV would be the Department of Health and Human Services that would provide STD, HIV, AIDS screenings right there on site. And then one RV would be the judge who actually held court on site. And then the next RV was the human service professionals, which that's the part that we play, that I play and my colleagues played. And they would get arrested. There would be vice that would go undercover and act as Johns, and they would solicit the prostitutes at these sites, and they would arrest them and bring them in, and they'd be in handcuffs, and we would do assessments right there in the middle of the horseshoe with them. And that's how I came to meet Peaches. She was one of the ladies that they arrested and brought in, and thankfully when she went before the judge, she did agree to participate in treatment. So that was how I got to meet her. And I actually, at that time, ran the women's unit through a facility called Homeward Bound in Dallas, Texas, which was an inpatient facility. And I was the senior counselor for the women's unit. It's a 29-bed inpatient facility. And the ladies that would come in, just like Peaches, they would get 90 days of intensive inpatient medication, counseling, education, support, anything and everything that we could possibly wrap around them to help them get clean and sober and stable mentally and support them to get back in the community.
Mm-hmm.
And so she was able to go through the 90-day program successfully. And then after that point, she was in our transitional living program for a year where she actually lived in the community and worked in the community. And she was just magnificent, very successful. And I'm happy to say today, for her at least, the scars are only on the inside now. I mean, she's just a whole new person. When you meet someone who has lived this lifestyle for so long, there's no life left. I mean, when you're working with them, when you're talking with them, they're just kind of like shells.
Right.
And, you know, I'm happy to say again today, and this has been, let's see, 4 years now, she's been clean, sober, on her own. She had had four children off and on throughout her lifestyle, from 16 to we got her, and she regained custody of two of those children.
Mm-hmm.
And she got her bachelor's degree.
Wow.
And she is working as a women's advocate in the program right now.
Oh, that's fabulous. Wow, what
yeah,
a turnaround.
So that's the one that I always like to say, because in the motto, you know, for the program, and it's the New Life Opportunities program that does this, all the community members that come together, is for the sake of one, because the success rate is horrific. There mm-hmm. there isn't much of one. But when you have so many different community programs coming together to support somebody, it is for that sake of one that anybody does it, and we do have success.
Yeah, that's wonderful that you're able to set up that community in that sort of fashion. I've never heard of that before. Is that kind of a unique situation to Dallas or the country even?
Well, I know that there was something in L.A., like Project Night, that tried to do something similar with juvenile prostitutes. In Dallas, juvenile prostitutes were kind of like the rock stars of the population. They were the ones that you'll never see them because the pimps took really good care of them. And they're young and they're beautiful and they, you know, they would always go to the nicest hotels and make all the money, and that's in the game, that's like the prime time is when you're young. And then as you get older and older, kind of your johns get I guess less glamorous, and there's not as much money made, and by that time usually you are addicted to multiple substances, and you're not as, you know, young and fresh and all of that.
Probably so, rather worn out by that point after,
yeah,
you know, after so many years of doing prostitution.
Definitely. But I think it was like Project Night or Project Streets in L.A., and I don't know if it's even still going. I've been here for a year now, and I haven't been able to plug in yet mm-hmm. like I would like to on the clinical aspect of my work, because I would love to continue it, because I know we have it. I know it's happening right now, right here. I can't go to a truck stop without wanting to do an intervention multiple times, because after you've did it, and I did that for 3 years, and after you've did it, you just know. I mean, you know this, all the signs that someone's a pimp or a prostitute or a trick. And, of course, a trick is another name for a john mm-hmm. or a client.
Yeah, so about what ages do girls typically get into doing this type of prostitution?
The truck stop prostitutes are typically between 40 and 65. They're on their last kind of leg. They're on the last part of the journey where they're fully addicted to multiple things. Most of them do have some form of STD. And they're typically homeless or just living from john to john or with friends or on the streets. Our population, we're not the glamorous ones. Usually when you get into the lifestyle, it does start very young, you know, anywhere from 12 to 14. And like with Peaches, she started at 16, dancing and stripping. And that's kind of the entryway process for prostitutes, is the dance clubs and the strip clubs, because it seems so glamorous, and you start getting hooked on the money and the sex and the drugs, and you just think that, you know, it's going to be wonderful, and before you know it, you're 5 years in, you still don't have the GED, you're 10 years in, you're not as pretty as you were, and it's very insidious the way that the lifestyle takes you. And like I said, I had one lady, she was 62, and that's all she had ever done. I mean, her mom had traded her for, I believe she told me, a pulled pork sandwich when she was nine. It was a generational prostitution. And that's something else that we found, is there was generational prostitution that happened. These women would turn out their own kids that were in this lifestyle. They were so sick and brainwashed. And so anyway, the typical for a truck stop prostitute is between 40 and 65, and that's what my research showed. But the typical prostitute, of course, there would be different statistics just for a general prostitute, but we're more focused on the truck stop prostitutes. That's more what my research is on.
Yeah, I would imagine it's a very hidden population, and this is the first time that I've heard about this type of research. And, you know, again, this is one of those almost taboo subjects, like it just, you know, society just wants to hide it away and just pretend it doesn't even exist.
Absolutely, because if they admitted it, then they would have to get involved and do something, and they'd have to look at it, and they don't want to. That's definitely true.
Yeah. Now, did you do any research on the end of what the trucking industry has to say about all of this?
Not at all. The way that the New Life Opportunities Project even came about, there was a sergeant named Louis Fellini in Dallas that he was constantly seeing this revolving door for prostitutes. They would come in, they'd get booked, they'd spend one or two nights, and they were back on the street. And it was just costing not only in the human factor, which it's amazing that he had as much love and empathy as he had, but it was just totally a waste of resources, totally pointless. And he's actually the one that approached the mental health and substance abuse community there in Dallas to see if they could all work together to try to intervene and try to help do something different so it wouldn't be the revolving door. And once that started happening, he had shared that there were a number of different serial killers that were using the truck stops and killing women, and that they had hoped through doing this kind of work that they would ultimately get some of those as well. Because the whole idea behind it for them in law enforcement was to get the Johns and the pimps, not necessarily the prostitutes, but to go further than that.
Yeah, I was wondering about that when you were talking about that initially, if they were also arresting the Johns on, in the whole scenario, because, I mean, they're, breaking the law also, so.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah. And that's the piece that I don't have as much research or knowledge on as I would like. That's something that I know that they did work with the FBI, that the Dallas police worked closely with Homeland Security as well. So I know that they worked with many different entities outside of just the community mental health industry that tried to work together to help support the population. But the results and the extent of it, I do not know. I would think that at some point someone would have reached out to the truck stop or the truck driving community, but I do not know that. I don't have that information.
Yeah, and you would think that that would be hopefully addressed by, like, the trucking the unions. If any of these truckers are unionized, because, I mean, they're spreading disease if they're going, like, from one truck stop to another and not using any condoms or, having irresponsible sex, they can be contagious.
Sure. Oh, yeah, definitely. You would think that, but I don't have, any knowledge of what they pursued with the trucking. I know that many of the people that we would end up getting and talking to, the Johns and the gentlemen that were at the truck stops, they just, I don't know, it was funny. They're just kind of like, they would call them lot lizards and just say that it was part of the lifestyle of being someone who's a trucker. It's just like this subculture mm-hmm. that's existing right beside our on our interstates. And it's just... I would love to do more research on it.
That would be fascinating.
But it's just something else. It's amazing.
Yes, it is. Dr. Shabander, we are going to take a commercial break. When we come back, I would like to talk to you about how you initially got into researching prostitution.
Okay. Sounds good.
Are you searching for answers and insight to life issues? Is the behavior of family or friends questionable or concerning? Find tips and possible solutions from the convenience of your own PC, cell phone, or tablet at therapycable.com. Therapy Cable has the most comprehensive library of contemporary therapy videos online. Help may be as easy as a few clicks away. Therapy Cable offers comprehensive therapy videos ranging from addiction to self-care and contact information for qualified providers. Find the answers to your life challenges at therapycable.com.
And welcome back to Psych 101 with Julianne Good and Dr. Joy Shabander. And we are talking about prostitution this evening. If you would like to join us on this conversation, our number is 800-893-9562. Again, that's 800-893-9562. So, Dr. Shabander, how did you get into researching prostitution initially?
Well, I had started working in domestic violence and sexual assault early on in my getting my license, my Oklahoma State license, to be a mental health counselor. And I know, even though it wasn't called prostitution, many of the individuals I worked with described trading sex for either favors or money or services. And even though it wasn't called prostitution, that started me thinking, it really is, though. I mean, anytime you trade in sex for anything, that's pretty much the definition of prostitution. Mm-hmm. And early on, that was an area of interest because it seemed like women, especially the characteristics of the women that I worked with domestic violence, the skills and the occupational outlook for them was so low that a lot of times they would use sex to get their needs met. I had one lady I worked with, she traded sex to her mechanic because she couldn't pay him with cash to get her car fixed, and she was a single mom with two kids. And so I've always had that interest, and I've always seen it in my populations that I've worked with. And I did the domestic violence, the victims and the perpetrators, and drug court for about 8 years before I ended up in Dallas. And when I came to Dallas, everyone, all the people I worked with, had some level of prostitution that had happened. But the most, saturated population was the New Life Opportunities population. And that was a program that was already up and running when I arrived. My director, Renee Brazil, continues to run it in Dallas right now. And Sergeant Louis Fellini is also there and continues to run it. And I had the privilege of running the 29-bed unit that the women would come to for their 90 days. And so it's partly what I wanted to search out, because I've always had an interest in that. And then the other part is just being lucky enough to get the positions that put me in the right place at the right time to get to pursue that research.
That is valuable. You have to be able to get the correct experience to be able to go and do that research properly.
Mm-hmm, definitely. And I felt like I got to have a double dose because even after I didn't work with Homeward Bound as the women's unit director or senior counselor, I still volunteered. A year after I was gone, I would come back every month and do the sweeps and do the crisis assessments on the street and continue to do that simply because I have a passion for it. And my heart goes out to these women that, you know, all they've known is some type of abuse, and for the majority of their lives, and the amazing strength, inner strength, and resiliency it takes to be able to get out of that and to live something different is just awe-inspiring to me. And
yes,
getting to be a part of that process and see that occur, there's no equal, as far as I'm concerned, in the human services profession than to be a part of that.
Brave women.
Amazingly.
Yes.
And that's if they don't die. You know, unfortunately, I had several that passed away. They've used their bodies for so long in this manner that their bodies just give out. You know, they just either from the hepatitis or from the HIV or from cancer.
Yeah.
So I've had many pass.
Yeah, that must be rough.
Definitely.
Know.
Definitely.
Yes. Yes. So,
yeah.
Now, you were talking about the abuse factor before. Did you find in working with these women that was a really common factor?
100%.
Wow.
Of the population experienced some type of childhood sexual trauma.
Wow. That's
None
astounding.
Did not. Yeah. Yeah, none did not. And I have to be real careful with this. I had a professor that was on my panel, my internal review board panel on my dissertation, cautioned me that I'm not saying that every child that has sexual abuse is going to be a prostitute.
Mm-hmm.
But I am saying that every prostitute I've ever known has had sexual abuse as a child.
So
you see what I mean?
Right. Oh, yeah, definitely. That makes complete sense. When you were working with them and the 90-day program, how much of that prior history would you go into with the women?
It depended on the woman. and where she was at. If she was ready and wanted to pursue that history, then of course we would pursue it. That's not anything that myself or my team of counselors would press at all. You have to be very careful. None of the ladies had just a single diagnosis. We've got individuals who have multiple diagnoses, from bipolar disorder, depressive disorder, anxiety disorder. They all have the PTSD disorder, post-traumatic stress disorder. And then we've got our addiction issues as well, which could be polysubstance dependent or alcohol dependent, crack cocaine dependent. And any one of those is complicated enough to address in therapy, much less adding on childhood trauma issues, which more than likely, even though they may be the origin that led to some of the choices that resulted in where they are today, you have to be ready to work on them for them to be addressed. Otherwise, it could be more damaging to the individual.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that's more of a intensive outpatient pursuit. In the 90 days, we're just trying to get them stable mentally, get them detoxed completely and with a good solid recovery plan. And then when they go through their outpatient, well, their intensive outpatient is 10 hours a week of group and individual counseling and support groups. And they do that from 6 months to a year.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that, it's more of the outpatient counseling. And that's when you're really going to start to address some of those origin issues. And that's what we call them, the origin issues. And those are the things that happened early on that kind of steered them towards the choices they made that resulted in the events that led them to where they were today.
So in other words, it's kind of like the 90 days is prep work.
Yes,
for them
definitely.
To do the intensive outpatient, to really start going through and getting comfortable with that process of
yes.
hooking up the childhood abuse that they had been through, to kind of do the bridging of, okay, well, this is why I'm doing what I'm doing now, because they may have buried it so deeply with sex and drugs and alcohol and anything else that they're doing to numb out from what they had been through. Is that correct?
Absolutely. You nailed it. Hit the nail on the head. That's it. You don't really want it. It wouldn't be really productive to go there in the beginning until they do have some stability, and it could even trigger a relapse. And when I say a relapse, I not only mean a relapse for the substances, but I mean a relapse into that lifestyle, because that's the lifestyle that they know. And every time, you know, they need deodorant or they need, you know, some hair products, if they turn a trick, they can get money in, you know, 10 minutes, and they know how to do it.
Yeah.
So I found that a lot of the ladies would fall back into the lifestyle off and on as they were triggered and needed money. Or different things would happen that would upset them. And just like you and I might, you know, have had a bad day and we use our support system and, you know, call somebody and vent or you know, go swimming or something like that, they might do a bump or get loaded or turn a trick to feel powerful and get money, because that's how they know how to do it, and they can do it quick and they're good at it and they know that. And so there's always, especially early on in that first 90 days, you have, and unfortunately we had a men's unit there too. And so we would have to really watch and be careful, because sometimes they would sneak out and do what they do, you know?
Yeah, I would imagine that it would be difficult within that 90 days, especially if it's the first time through. For
yeah.
them to want to make the commitment to staying and not rebelling against the system.
Yes.
You know, and
yes.
just convincing them this is for your good. This is for your ultimate survival.
Well, it's kind of like, I don't know if you're familiar with the trans-theoretical stages of change DeClemente and Paul Huska, motivational interviewing. But
yes, it's wonderful.
Basically, that's a fancy way of saying you roll with resistance and you find whatever they want, and that's what you encourage. And so they want to be out of jail. So everything you do with them is to go back to say, are these choices going to get you right back in jail, or are these choices going to support you staying out and being independent? And that way you have an ally when you work with them, because you two, you're not the system then. You're an ally to them. You're part of their support group then, because you want what they want, which is to stay out of jail. And if we sneak off to the men's unit and turn a trick, is that keeping you out of jail? Because that's going to get you kicked out of treatment. You know, so you just kind of always bring it back to that.
Self-responsibility, basically.
Yeah. And like you said, early on in the stages of change, which, again, I don't know if you're familiar with that.
Yes,
but,
I am. Yes.
Yeah. A lot of times, you know, the pre-contemplation stage is the FU stage of change. Nobody wants to change, and they're playing the game with you, and they usually don't make it. And then we've got the contemplation stage of change where they, you know, maybe make it 30 days, but they really want to go out there and do their old lifestyle. It's so many rules here. They're on the fence. They're back and forth. And then we've got the preparation stage, and that's when they decide, yeah, I'm going to stick with it. You know, I'm going to do something different. And then the action stage, which means they actually live it. We've got 90 days now. We've got, you know, 120 days now. And then if we're lucky enough to make it to the maintenance stage, you know, we're a year or two in and we're doing it. We've got sobriety under our belt. We haven't turned a trick. You know, we're living without abuse. We're independent. And that's really the goal.
It is. And it sounds like so much work. But, boy, I like with Peaches, what a wonderful story of success.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, you can get out of prostitution.
Oh, yeah.
You can get out of being an addict. You can turn your life around and make it productive. And with her too, you know, her and her two children, and what a change for all three of them. What a fantastic program.
Yeah.
You know, should be advertised more, honestly, because seriously, yeah. I haven't heard of a program like this, because it is just not, this information isn't out in the general public.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I know in Dallas, it was kind of a nation model. They looked at it as a model for the nation.
It should be.
And if it worked, they did discuss starting it in different locations. And it would be great to start, you know, one in the Los Angeles area, because it's needed.
Yes, I agree.
However, the ticket is you have to have law enforcement that's willing to work in conjunction with human services to make it happen. And sometimes law enforcement's viewpoint has been punitive rather than a rehabilitative. And I don't know, you know, here. I would love to hear about a place that does something like this. I don't think there is that I know of here.
Maybe you could start it.
Well, you know, and I've thought about that, because we need it, and we have it. But it's just, I feel like I'm in the dark to a big degree, because I don't even know all the different human services agencies, and that takes years to know the ins and outs and the names and who they are. And like I said, in Dallas, I was the one that came in from the outside. I had moved from Colorado to Texas, and it had already been going for a year, and there was such a beautiful connection between law enforcement and the human services providers.
As it should be.
I don't
be.
Know.
Yeah.
Yeah, as there should be. And it was beautiful, but I don't know how to model that or mimic that here, unless there are others out there that are listening or that have the same heart to do something like that, then of course I would be on board and do anything I could to make it happen.
And actually, after the show, I can probably connect you up to some people along those lines, so.
Okay.
Yes, I've got a network down in Orange County, so.
Okay, that That
yes.
sounds great.
Yes, that's wonderful. We are going to take another break, and when we come back, I'd like to talk to you about what the NLO is, okay?
Okay, sounds good.
All right, thank you. To Psych One-on-One with Julianne Gunn and Dr. Joy Shabander. And we are talking about prostitution this evening. Dr. Shabander, what is the NLO and how does it help prostitutes?
NLO is New Life Opportunities, and it is comprised of law enforcement, mental health providers, and multiple organizations within the Dallas area. They came together to do For the Sake of One, which is that's their motto, is For the Sake of One. It was originated by the Dallas Police Department that identified the revolving door of the prostitutes that came from the truck stops where they would be arrested one day and get out within 2 days and be right back on the street. And the punitive measures had failed miserably. To do anything to interrupt this process. Sorry about that. And so they approached the addiction professionals, which was at Homeward Bound, which is a multi-level facility with detox, crisis stabilization, inpatient and outpatient programs for dual diagnosis, mental health and addiction individuals who had those issues. And from there, it started once a month where they would go and do what's called street sweeps, which is prostitution diversion. And any diversion services, the whole goal behind that is to provide an alternative to incarceration. And so it's basically to divert the individual to do something else. So once a month, they would go to a popular truck stop where there was a lot of prostitution activity. Many times for us, it was the I-10, right off the I-10 in Dallas. We would set up from peak times, 11 p.m. to 3 a.m., and all of us were volunteers, even the judges and the law enforcement were volunteers, and they would go out, the vice would go out, pose as Johns, prostitutes would be arrested, they would come in and be processed through the health department, again to identify any medical needs or issues, and then through mental health and addiction specialists who would do on-site crisis stabilization and assessments to identify if they would be eligible and agreeable as to go to treatment as an alternative to incarceration. And then they would go before the judge, and the judge would go on the treatment, the mental health treatment professional's recommendation. And so they'd actually be court-ordered on the site to treatment. Then from there, they would actually go off to treatment. And there were several facilities that worked together. There was Nexus, which is just women, for women and young children, and then Homeward Bound. They would be funneled into these treatment programs. And they would stay in them for 90 days, sometimes a little longer. And then they would be set up in the community with transitional housing, sober living environments, if you're familiar with that model of sober living environments.
Yes.
Where everyone works together in a environment free from drugs and alcohol and criminal behavior. Everybody pitches in, they have jobs, and that's what the NLO program did and does, still does. They've been going strong. Let's see. I was started there in 08, and so they started in 07. So, and it's 2014, 7 years into it now.
And have they branched off? Have they branched off into any other cities with this model?
I know that they had started doing national conferences that were drawing in different people from different cities. I know that they were working with the FBI about the time I left in the summer of 2011. And I know they were doing a lot of different things at that time. But I don't know what specifically has happened with that program since then. I know that the core program is still going every month. I still get notices every month about the sweeps that are occurring, and that so women are still being helped, but I don't know if that program is being modeled anywhere else.
And it should be. I mean, it sounds like a fantastic program that would help a lot of people.
Yeah, I agree completely.
I mean, prostitution is a reality, and we need to be dealing with it better. It, you know, I've heard a little bit about the system that they have in Amsterdam and such. They at least regulate it, and, you know, they keep track of it, and because it's like it's a reality all over the world. So, you know, let's not make it a judgment call. Let's go help people with the situation.
Completely.
Yes.
And, you know, everyone that's out there, they're not doing it because they want to be a prostitute. You know, that's just a symptom of the issue. You know, there is some serious mental health, neglect, and abuse issues happening. Otherwise, they would not be there. So this is not someone that we need to be punitive with anyway.
Exactly.
So
how did you find that a lot of, I should say people, because it's also men, like you had mentioned before, that get into prostitution. How do they initially get into the profession?
Well, all the ones that I worked with, they were either turned out by a friend or a relative, and that's what they call it, turning out. That's when somebody who's in the lifestyle tells you how awesome it is and how glamorous and how much money you can make and how easy it is and all the drugs, and they make it look glamorous. So that would be a friend or a family member. Another way is like what Peaches did. You know, she was 16, had no skills, so she started stripping and dancing. And that leads to propositions, trading sex for money and drugs. And she went from there. Those are the two ways that I know of that most often individuals end up in that lifestyle.
And if somebody that is listening is either doing prostitution or knows a prostitute, what would you recommend to that person as to how to get out?
Well, they've got to seek out that help. You know, get yourself into a treatment facility, because that is the first step. Once you do get kind of clean and sober, or on the way to clean and sober, I'm all for the graduated or response to substance use. I'm not saying cold turkey. I'm just saying get the process started, you know, with the treatment for the substances. At the same time, the mental health treatment has to be addressed, because a lot of times we use the substances because we can't stand our own thoughts. We can't stand ourselves, period. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's the mental health aspect of it. You've got to do both. And that's why so many times treatment fails, is because they think, well, if I do the mental health stuff, then that'll help. And they don't address the addiction, or they think, oh, if I do the addiction, that'll help. But they don't address the mental health. And the reality is, if you don't address both, you will fail, mm-hmm. period. You have to address both. So seek out the treatment and get started. And it gets easier as time goes by. It does not get harder. That's one beautiful thing. At first, it's a monster, and you think you're going to crawl out of your own body. It's horrible, horrific at first.
Yes.
But then it gets easier, and it gets easier and better as time goes on, and you get stronger and healthier. And eventually, that old lifestyle is a pale reminder from what your new lifestyle is, and all the legitimate and healthy joy that you experience from it now versus what was before.
Yeah, and it's a marvelous life ahead. That's the whole thing, you know, and there's hope.
Exactly. And that's what you've got to remember.
Love, and yes.
Yes, legitimate, healthy love, not somebody that just wants to, you know, have sex with you or do a bump with you, mm-hmm. or use you in some other way. It's truly, there is a truly rewarding, unconditional love life out there just waiting to be had, and it can be had. I mean, they're still worthwhile. Many times they don't feel like they're worth anything at this point, but they're not. They're not throwaway people. They're not trash people. They're just as valid human beings as any
yes.
of us. And any of
yes.
us could have ended up the same way that they did if we would have been in those same circumstances.
Right.
And that's like you said before with the judgment. You can't judge anybody until you've walked a mile in their shoes. And even then you can't.
Exactly. Because everybody's experience is different. Yeah, and now building up the self-esteem, is that part of the 90-day program also?
Oh, yes. We address all of that.
Yeah.
We have multiple groups and individual sessions every single day. It's like boot camp. It's like mental health addiction boot camp. And we have licensed clinicians and case managers and different agencies come in, and it's exhausting emotionally, but it's a beautiful thing. We have group counseling, group education. We even have steps to success on resume writing, professional dress, how to interview.
It's important.
Because I laugh, but one of the things that I did, one of the ladies, she had never went to a restaurant, ever. She had, you know, other than like Taco Bell or something like that. And it just floored me. And I asked, we had 22 on the unit at that time. And I asked, you know, how many of you have never actually went to a restaurant, a sit-down restaurant, and, you know, had a meal? And there were like 12 out of the 22 had never had that, because they were so mired in all this other stuff and the drugs and the, you know, all this lifestyle. And so we all got dressed up and we went out to a real restaurant and we had a real meal, and it was just a positive, healthy experience for them.
Yeah.
And there were no strings attached. They didn't have to put out at the end or anything.
Yeah.
So,
and it's amazing. I mean, the experiences we take for granted.
Yes, and we do.
Right, and for a life of a prostitute, there is probably not a lot of that normalcy within their everyday lives.
Mm-hmm. There is not.
So it's amazing. It's, you know, it's sad. It really is. It just,
yeah.
You know, I can just imagine the stories that you've heard from many of the prostitutes. Probably just astounded you, I would imagine.
Well, you know, unfortunately, like I said before, when I very first started the work that I've done, My first job was at a domestic violence shelter, and it's amazing the level of sexual trauma and just physical abuse that women have went through. And I know males have went through this as well.
Yes.
But right early on, I don't feel like I heard anything different from the prostitutes that I hadn't heard already from the different survivors of domestic violence and sexual assault that I very first started working with.
Yes, I worked in a DV shelter also, and yeah, mm-hmm. I did hear many tales, and that was the first time they had ever had any mental health counseling was when they were in shelter with us for 30 days.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's when I heard the first real horrific tales of domestic violence and prostitution was even there. I had one lady, she traded her 14-year-old's virginity for a pack of cigarettes.
Oh.
That was one of my first clients when I was 21. So I feel like for me, I, right off the bat, I think you're emerged in this kind of subculture that's happening under our noses.
Yes.
That people think isn't happening, and you want to not only help those individuals but become an advocate and make sure that you are a voice for them
and protect them as much as you can within the realms of your profession.
Yes.
Well, Dr. Shabander, as we are wrapping up, is there anything else that you'd like to add in about a minute?
Well, let's see. I think the main points that I said, so I'm pretty good with that. Right now I am working for Argosy University, and I run a forensic psychology program, a master's degree program, and it's wonderful. I get to teach some of the courses as well as working with all the students getting their master's degree in forensic psychology, and that's a wonderful experience. And I get to bring real-world experience to them from my past and all the work I've been lucky enough to do.
That's wonderful.
But I'm still missing my clinical component, which I am anxiously looking to get back into the clinical part of it.
Yes.
So that's the only other thing I can think of to add. And thank you so much for having me.
Well, thank you, Dr. Shabander. And if anybody would like to contact you, would you like to give out that information?
Oh, sure. Yeah, I can give out my email and a good work number. So my email is J, S as in Sam, H, A as in Apple, B as in Boy, A as in Apple, N, D as in Dog, A as in Apple, R, at Argosy, Argosy.edu. And then my number would be 909-472-0651.
Great. Thank you so much, Dr. Shabander. It was wonderful having you on.
Thank you very much.
Take care.
You too. Bye-bye.
And thank you so much for joining me on Psych 1-on-1. I am on every Monday between 7 and 8 Pacific Standard Time. The show is archived within 24 to 48 hours, so if you'd like to re-listen to this broadcast or if you missed part of it, you can always go on to skidrowstudios.com and pull it up. And we also are on iTunes Store under podcast, under Psych 1-on-1. And if you'd like to contact me, my email address is jgoode8@verizon.net. My office number is 562-234-4650. And thank you so much for joining me. I'd like to thank Jenny Guzman, my board op, Jeremy Hansen, our executive producer for Skid Row Studios. And join me every Monday. Take care of yourself. Take care of each other now.